Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Now at Topgolf, you get half off golf Monday through Wednesday when you book in the app. It could be any Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. Like this Monday, next Tuesday, and the following Wednesday. Or maybe this Wednesday, next Tuesday, and the Monday after that. Basically, any Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday is a good day, as long as you spend it at Topgolf. It's golf. It's half off. It's half off golf. Monday through Wednesday when you book in the app for a limited time only. So download the Topgolf app, book a bay, and come play around. Restrictions and exclusions may apply. Visit topgolf.com/halfoffgolf for details.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Olga Buliuk and Ladan Rahbari. Olga is an assistant professor of Europe's external relations at the University of Amsterdam, an affiliate at the Amsterdam Center for European Studies. She conducts research and teaches courses on EU's relations with the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, specifically Ukraine, on civil society in Ukraine post-Euromaidan, and on EU cultural diplomacy in Ukraine and beyond. Her current project explores the politics of knowledge production and expertise in the debate on Russia's war against Ukraine. Prior to joining the University of Amsterdam, Olga has worked at the University of Kent, UK, the College of Europe, Harvard University, US, and Ghent University, Belgium. Ladan is an assistant professor at the Department of Sociology at the University of Amsterdam and a senior researcher at the International Migration Institute, IMI. She was formerly the recipient of an FWO, Research Foundation Flanders Postdoctoral Fellowship, 2019 to 2022. She obtained a PhD in Gender and Diversity Studies from UGent and VUB, 2019, and a PhD in Sociology, 2015. Her research interests include gender or sexual politics, gender-based state violence and violence against women, political activism with a focus on Iran and the Iranian diaspora in Western Europe, and in the frameworks of post-colonial feminist and critical theories. Ladan is a board member of the Amsterdam Research Center for Gender and Sexuality and the Amsterdam Center for Migration Research. Between September 2019 and September 2020, Ladan was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Diversity and Gender Studies. She is currently a member of the same journal's editorial board. She is also a member of Amsterdam Young Academy 2021 to 2026. In today's conversation, we are going to discuss their edited book, Migrant Academics, Narratives of Precarity and Resilience in Europe, published by Open Book Publishers in 2023. Ladan and Olga, I welcome you to this discussion and thank you for giving me your valuable time.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for your interest in the work.
Right. So let me first begin the discussion by asking you about the motivation behind putting this book together.
I will jump in with this question, if you don't mind. It's interesting that you open by asking about the motivation behind this book, because once the book was published and we sat down and paused to reflect on the process, we realized that throughout the time that we worked on it, it ran on motivation. It's ironic that the book on academic precarity has been a precarious academic project, because at the time when we started, what I mean here by precarious academic project, I mean that it was not a project that has received designated funding. It was not a book that was written for, a concrete book contract. Actually, at the time when we started working on this, Ladan and I have never met in person. We met each other through our work, through the essays we wrote and, which we read and which resonated strongly. So, throughout the process, of working on this book, it ran very much in our motivation to work on this topic and, you know, to dedicate time and effort to it. Now, as I already just mentioned briefly, Laden and I never met before we started working on this book. I read Laden's work, Laden read my work. We got in touch and met on Zoom because this was the time of COVID lockdowns and restrictions, and there was absolutely no way for us to meet in person. At that time, we lived in different countries. We worked at different universities. And we just realized that there's so much resonance and similarity and mutual understanding, you know, of each other, of our trajectories, of our work, even though, you know, we are placed in different universities, different disciplines, we come from different countries, we worked in different countries. So yeah, we came together to put this, I mean, it's technically called an edited volume, but we like to refer to it as a curated collection, because we were very carefully working on the essays, on the stories that the authors have contributed to this volume. Yeah, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit. Maybe Lada wants to jump in, or maybe
yes, I can do that.
Specify the question.
Yeah. I'll pick up from there. First of all, let me just thank you for the generous introduction that you gave of us, for myself and Olga, and I'm very happy to be here. I will maybe talk a little bit about the motivation behind putting this book together. And let me start by saying that we come from a place of frustration. So migrant academics feeling very frustrated over how universities basically treat them. And we, I guess this is something in the West, but I think it's also generally everywhere. We are in academic institutions these days that claim that they are diverse, that they are inclusive. And if they are not, they are aiming to reach there, right? So this issue of diversity and inclusion is very central to universities. But then the experience of the actual life experience of migrant academics is that when they raise questions of, you know, discrimination or bias or violence, sometimes even at the university, they face dismissal, they face silencing. They have to sit in meetings where, you know, they have to face the feelings of the perpetrators basically being exposed. The institution claims that by exposing issues of discrimination and bias, they are hurting the institution. So in a way, the role of the victim and the perpetrator sometimes gets reversed in these processes. And so for migrant academics, to come together in this collection was to basically expose the emotional and political labor that we are doing behind closed doors, right? So these are not things that we necessarily discuss openly in academia. But of course, we do talk about these things among ourselves. So this is something that migrant academics are talking to each other about. So we, you know, this is kind of our pastime. We sit with each other and we talk about how we experience discrimination, we experience biases, microaggressions, and sometimes even more precarious forms of circumstances in the university. But it was this. So the motivation was to kind of, you know, collectivize this work that was already happening on an individual basis by migrant academics. And we wanted to frame it in an academic way. And I can maybe explain a little bit about that in the next questions, if there is time, about how we see this book as an academic practice, but based on emotional and political labor that migrant academics are already doing.
I think, you know, I can pick up on this and actually ask you to talk a little bit more about what you mean by these practices and, you know, the emotional labor that migrant academics are doing.
Yeah, maybe I can pick up here and also here then connected to the role of narratives, right? So basically, the thing is that migrant academics are, the chapters of the book are a very good testimony of, are experiencing all sorts of systemic issues. Now, some of these issues fall outside of academia, so their sources are outside of academia, but some of them are caused within academia because of the existing structures within academia. And whether it is the things that are outside but aggravated on the inside. So for instance, when it comes to, you know, academic mobility, this is an issue that is not necessarily directly caused by academia, but it's also not tackled very well within academia. So the way that university policies are put in place, or for instance, visa procedures are facilitated, or I don't know, even like small things like housing, thinking about like migrant academics moving around all the time, how much assistance do they get when they are in precarious situations? So these are things that migrant academics experience, but they are left alone in tackling them. And they are sometimes, in a way, talked down to if they expose these issues as issues that are relevant to the university, right? And I want to bring in here also the issue of narratives, because so for us, it was very, very important to capture the micro, the meso, and the macro levels of experiences that academics have. So not only the structural level things, but also, you know, the relationship that the academic has with the institution, and the very emotional and embodied experience of the precarities that they face. And to have all of this within, you know, a chapter really required us to focus on narratives. So we really want to say that for us, narratives were the way to go. They were the most privileged way to talk about all these, you know, different levels, and as repertoires of all levels of analysis. So bringing really the individual, the history, the institution all together. And the other thing that we wanted to do was that, as you mentioned, the kind of the emotional and political work, was that the emotional and the political work is already happening. So there is this, and I'm going to quote Sara Ahmed, you know, the killjoy work of complaining and doing the analysis of what is wrong with the institution is already happening in private spaces when academics, migrant academics talk to each other. But we wanted to kind of give... I don't want to say give voice, because that voice exists, but we wanted to frame it within an academic kind of collective. And that is how our stories came together.
If I may jump in here and, building on the word collective, Ladan just used, and also going back to the initial question on the motivation, you know, what started as each of us living through our individual lives and, you know, trying to give meaning to our individual experiences, you know, then you share with a few people in your, you know, personal network, in your professional network, and you realize that there are, you know, some echoes and resonances. But what happened that once, you know, Ladan and I published our, you know, early work on this, we got huge feedback from people who would say, you know, I just, you know, changed the year and the place and maybe some names. And, you know, I've lived similar episodes. And that's also what we wanted to show with this book, is that, you know, it goes way beyond the individual experiences and is much more about the patterns and the systemic issues, as Ladan was just saying. But, you know, it's only through the individual through the individual stories that you can actually illustrate and expose fully, and also in a very human and relatable way. And I just want to share an anecdote of how we were working on this, right? Because authors would be writing up their individual contributions, and Ladan and I would read them carefully, you know, leaving all sorts and types of feedback, right? So the drafts would go back and forth. And what would often happen is that on the margins, in the comments, we would be, you know, sharing our own anecdotes, mm-hmm. right. certain events, you know, discriminations, microaggressions, absurdities, I would even call it, you know, and we would say, oh, you know, this happened to me then and then, oh, wait till you hear, you know, oh, do you want to know, you know, how this went with me back in, you know, whatever, fill in the year. So we were already, you know, just between Ladan and I, and each of the authors, we were already in this, you know, kind of dialogue with the three of us. And it's beautiful to see how the book now, you know, goes way beyond our little collective, I want to say, because it's just 23 people on board, but it's actually a huge group of people for an academic project, you know, to see how this goes beyond and how many more people, how many more migrant scholars find themselves in the different essays in the book.
Right. I was actually going to also ask about the role of narratives or stories, but I think Ladan and you have more or less answered the question. So, you know, I also want to know how the term migrant is used in this book. You know, who do you mean by that?
So, The book is about migrant academics, right? And that was the necessary criterion for inviting people to contribute to the book, right? That they would be migrants and academics. In practice, we did not work, we do not believe that there should be or can be one definition of what a migrant is or who a migrant is or who a migrant academic is. And we also did not feel that that was necessary for this book. So what happened is that we left this to self-identification. You know, what is a migrant? What is a migrant experience? What types of mobilities? So in this book, we do not work with one definition of what a migrant, what migrancy is, who a migrant is, right? So we left that to the self-identification of the authors. And in fact, that's also something that's being explored on the pages of the book, right? When authors frame different positionalities and different experiences as migrant experience. Now, in practice, that would often be... the contributors to the book usually, you know, went to other countries to work. Some of them stayed, some of them came back, some of them moved on to other countries. So there is a lot of diversity on this among the contributors to the book. Contributions and contributors also vary on their countries, you know, their respective home countries, countries of origins, but also their host countries. And I would say that probably for almost all of the authors, they have had multiple countries of stay in the global north. And actually, some of the authors have returned, right? So they are writing up their stories, their reflections from the experience of having returned to their home countries eventually.
Maybe I can come in here. So I just want to say, so we, just like Olga said, we did not want to really define migrants, the migrant experience. Migrancy is super diverse, and there's no one singular way that you can capture it. But what I can add to what you were saying so far, Olga, or maybe I can add actually two things. The first thing is that, so we wanted to talk about migration in relation to academia, because mobility is so naturalized in academia. It's almost as if to be a quote-unquote successful academic, you have to be mobile. You're expected to be mobile. And it's not a choice anymore. It is different when it is a choice, when mobility is a choice. It can be a very, you know, privileged thing to be able to be mobile. But once it becomes a mode of survival, once you have to, you know, move not only necessarily temporarily, sometimes even for, you know, longer periods of time, multiple times throughout your career, well, I would not necessarily consider that a privilege or something fun anymore at all. And the second thing is that mobility is considered a privilege. And I've heard people say this, saying, you know, well, you academics can find jobs in other countries, and that's a good thing because, you know, your pool is bigger. And, you know, it is true that this is one of those sectors where you can find jobs in other countries. And that can be a privilege. I think there is some privilege in that. However, to think about this privilege, we have to also think about a privilege of who, right? Because if you have a high power passport, if you're a person who has, you know, one of these privileged passports in the world, and, you know, basically, what do they say, that the world is your oyster? You can go wherever you want. Doors open for you. Borders open for you. You don't have to apply for visas. You don't have to go through sometimes very violent border regimes. But if you are one of those people who are racialized and have precarious passports, this is absolutely not a privilege. Moving can be unpleasant, uncomfortable, and sometimes a very unpleasant and even traumatic experience. So plus, besides this, it can also lead to all kinds of precarity because of the loss of, you know, long-standing networks and friends and family relationships, loss of stability, sense of home and belonging, and, you know, all the things that come with that. So we really wanted to add a much needed nuance to this discourse on, you know, naturalized and quote-unquote privileged migration experience, and to show that mobility itself can also lead to different forms of precarity.
And right. If I may just add a footnote to that, right? So Ladan very well pointed out that, you know, we address mobility as that mobility is very much a requirement of modern day academia, but it's also seen as a privilege. And I want to add to that, that also something that different contributions in the book pick up on, some more than others, is that this is also something that's not only a requirement by in the nature of academia, but also often expected of migrant academics. It's almost expected that you move on. It's expected that you don't stay. And that has really strong, really huge implications for how people feel integrated, for how people feel they belong to where they are, you know, how the host community accepts them or not, right? And yeah, I mean, besides the career opportunities and stuff like that.
Since we are also talking about precarity, so what is this precarity, and you know, what are the different forms in which one experiences it, particularly in the academic space?
Maybe I can start with this. So we use precarity to kind of analyze the state of affairs in the academy. So from hiring practices to, you know, problematic ways of dividing labor, you know, supervision experiences, systematic forms of discrimination, racialization, and gendered and racial hierarchies, and so on. So precarity is basically a term that we use to kind of, it encompasses all of these experiences. But it is not an absolute state. We are not considering precarity as an absolute state. We don't give one definition of it. We consider it a term that can change, and also a relative term. So think about this. So for instance, precarity can be considered a state in which an individual is unable to take care of themselves, like, you know, they can't financially provide for themselves or for those who rely on them. So this is a, you know, a state of precarity. But then there is also privileged states of precarity where someone has precarious conditions in one aspect of their life. And we have all kinds of arrays of precarity, including people who are in really precarious conditions in many aspects of their lives, or who perhaps in private life do not experience precarity, but when it comes to academia, they are very much in precarious situations. So it is really a term that contains different forms of experiences, that, again, depending on individual lives and structures. So we don't define it in that way. Another thing is that we wanted to show that basically all forms of precarity that we see in the larger society also exist in academia. We wanted to show that unlike how academia presents itself, and unlike how it is oftentimes, you know, associated with high social status, progressiveness, and, you know, also because academics themselves engage with the question of precarity as a research question, there is sometimes this kind of false image that academia is immune from things that it researches. But we wanted to show the opposite. We wanted to show that this is not the case, that we also experience precarity in academia, to kind of break this kind of facade of academia being fundamentally different from other institutions in the society, as sometimes it is portrayed. So academia follows a capitalist and a neoliberal logic. It is also a white institutional space. There is you know, racism and colonial ways of knowledge production, but also running the kind of the whole apparatus of knowledge production. And it also inherits and I would say also reproduces existing forms of biases that we have in our societies based on different social factors. Plus, just to add that there is also specific forms of precarity, because academia is a social field with its own kinds of logic system and unique circumstances. So think about academic ranks that give access to power and resources to specific people, the supervisee-supervisor relationship, assessment models, publish and perish, and, you know, precarious contracts and so on and so forth. So there is precarity in the sense that we experience in the society that also leaks into academic spaces, and there is academic kind of specific forms of precarity that we have in academia. And one thing that we wanted to really highlight is that I go back to what I was saying in response to your previous question about mobility and migrancy, that the naturalized notion of mobility is also a source of precarity. New forms of precarity are also produced through migration because of, as I said, loss of resources, but also because just being a migrant adds another level of complexity to a lot of other forms of existing precarity.
Right. So when we talk about precarity, we also have to talk about resilience because...
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I'm interested in knowing what kind of resilience do these academics and precarious positions offer in the face of the situation?
Yeah, I will start with this question. Actually, you know, when we started working on the book, it was conceived as the book on migrant academics, narratives of precarity. And as we went on and as we were reading, you know, contribution after contribution as they were coming in, we realized that these are stories of precarity as much as stories of resilience. So much so that we decided to add, you know, a mention of resilience in the title. Indeed, you know, when one relays their experience of discrimination, marginalization, exclusion, non-belonging, various forms of precarity that are addressed on the pages of the book, you inevitably share how you've endured this, how you've coped with this, how you've lived through this in the face of the hardship of the situation. So, you know, the way we saw it, the way we grasped it working on the book is that resilience is the other side of precarity in a way. And, you know, maybe if you search for the word resilience on the book, it will not come up that many times, probably in the introduction, because we actually conceptualize it and talk about, you know, the neoliberal and non-neoliberal definitions of resilience and how resilience is not, a good distributed evenly. It's not a good at all, right? It's a capacity and people have it to different extents, also because precarity is not distributed evenly either. Right. But as you read the different essays, you will see that resilience is very much talked about, even if it's not mentioned by its name and not talked about in those very terms.
Yeah, maybe I can fill in here as well. So for us, it is very important, and I want to emphasize this here. We want to caution everyone not to romanticize this notion of resilience. This is absolutely not what we wanted to do, because resilience is really a concept that refers to, you know, individuals, but also communities and societies developing strategies to adapt to circumstances that they cannot change. And it is also not afforded to everyone in the same way as Olga was mentioning just now. So depending on the resources and, you know, the historical circumstances of different individual and communities and their background, they will be afforded different levels of resilience. So resilience is a reality, as Olga was mentioning very rightfully, but it is not an ideal state for us. It is not something that we want to aim for. And hence it should not be romanticized as, something that we want to, you know, we strive to go towards. We do celebrate resilience and the strategies that our participants and collaborators have in this book, but I think that it is very crucial for us, and this is basically the aim of this book, to think about ways that we can change the structures and not try to make individuals resist those structures better. So we really hope that the book is read in this way, by celebrating and also understanding the, you know, the different ways that individuals and migrant individuals and communities use strategies to adapt to circumstances in which they feel powerless or they are powerless. But we want to also think about ways that we can aim to go for that structural change.
So in the beginning, you had also mentioned that you had started working during the pandemic, right? So how has the pandemic further exacerbated academic precarity?
Yeah, this is a huge question, right? And there are different ways to approach this. First of all, maybe on COVID as the background context for this book. Mm-hmm. Indeed, Ladan and I, we met at the time of COVID pandemic when there were very strict lockdown rules in the countries that we were residing in. So much so that we could never meet. And we could also not meet with the authors. We could not easily meet at conferences. We could not organize author workshops or any of those things, right? So this book was very much produced in this disabling rather than enabling period and environment. It was also very much the context of the lives of the different contributing authors because of course, you know, all of us were dealing with the pandemic in our own ways and, you know, regarding to the rules of our countries of residence and regarding to our, you know, the families, the anxieties and all those things. You can also mention that, you know, for female academics who have families, right? The childcare duties have mm-hmm. been generally through the roof in this period with the closing. But I mean, also for male academics, right? So I just mean for those of us on board the project who have had children, this has been also an extremely difficult time to just be able to work on anything, period, right? And in that sense, it's extra remarkable and probably I should mention it here that many authors would deliver their essays ahead of the agreed deadlines, even though the circumstance and the general context has been so hard to work in. And I think that's its own tribute to how important this topic has been to the authors, and you know how much this has struck the chord, how much our contributors were willing to share and were happy that there is somebody to listen. COVID, this is, at the same time, this is not a book about COVID, you know, how did we survive COVID or what has COVID done to migrant academics? And it's not actually so much spoken of on the pages of the book because usually scholars, you know, would reflect on their past experiences in these essays more so than their current experiences. It does come up though in two essays directly, you know, in the essay by Nora Kireri, on the experience of death, set very much in the context of the COVID lockdown and her having arrived in France and go through this extremely anxiety-inducing period, locked up, you know, in a student accommodation by herself. It also comes up in the essay of an Indian colleague of ours, Sanam Rohi, who wrote also about the different ability of the governments and the systems to address the COVID pandemic and, you know, how difficult it is to be tucked away from your family, unable to help them or advise them or do anything for them, you know, because you're on the other side of the globe and how, you know, then this might affect your relationship also with your colleagues in the country of being. So yeah, COVID has been a very important factor to the book.
Let me also come in here by saying that, first of all, we know quite a bit about the impact of COVID on migrants. And like Olga said, this wasn't the central theme in our book, but it was very much in the subtext. So we know that COVID led to restrictions of movements, for instance, and that means that there were travel restrictions, border closures, migration plans were disrupted, and migrants got stranded. And this is so the chapter that Olga was talking about, our colleague's chapter, Sanam Ruhi's chapter, on, you know, her being in Europe when, you know, a devastating wave of COVID hits India, and that there is this sense of powerlessness. And sadly, she also loses a loved one. And she writes about, you know, how this experience of death is perceived differently in Europe. And for someone like Sanam, COVID really left a lifelong impact, because not only she was, because of being a migrant, she was stranded in Europe and she could not, you know, join her loved ones, but she also lost the chance of saying goodbye to someone she was very close to. So this is the way that COVID impacts migrants' lives. So separation from families and loved ones. And this also means that there is heightened risk of social exclusion, discrimination. And we also saw the rise of xenophobia in connection to COVID, but also sometimes indirectly impacted by COVID, and mental health issues arising from that as well. So the isolation and anxiety, and also a sense of uncertainty, right, which was shared. But then if you are a migrant, again, I want to go back to saying migration just adds a layer of precarity to every other precarious experience that you have. So of course, this uncertainty was you know, widespread across the society, but migrants were experiencing this in a more intense way. They didn't know where they can, you know, start moving, where they can see their families and their loved ones again. So if it was not directly loss of loved ones or getting ill, there were all sorts of other precarious conditions that migrants had to experience during this period.
Right. We talked a little bit about this in the previous answer as well, but do you think that the identities of, let's say, gender, race, and religion play a role in worsening academic precarity of migrants?
Very much so, right? As Sladen was already saying earlier when we talked about precarity, right? With this book, we try to explore the intersection. You know, academia is a precarious, you know, work environment for everyone involved. Being a migrant is a precarious way of being for everyone involved. The time we live in is a precarious time for everyone involved. Now let's see where, you know, what happens where the three overlap, where the three intersect, right? And add to that then aspects of gender, race, and religion. That's just the extra layer of precarity that people have to experience. And I think on the pages of our book, the dimensions of gender and race are addressed more so than the dimension of religion, right? So we have dedicated parts in the book on gendered precarity and sexualization. Although, of course, many more essays speak to gender than the 3-4 essays that I included in this part of the book. That we also have dedicated part of the book talking about the embodied differences, whiteness, non-whiteness, visible and invisible inclusions and exclusions, and, you know, the complexities of privilege. So we do talk a lot about, well, we, the author collective, right, talk a lot about the added precarity of gender and race, and maybe less so about religion. Yeah, there are many, many reasons for that. And maybe that's where Ladan would like to jump in. And this is something that definitely religion is an aspect we would like to explore more in our future work, the relationship between religion, academy, and academy, and the relationship between religion and precarity.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to fill in here, because I think religion, and specifically from this location that we are speaking, right? So Olga and I are at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And I think this is absolutely, religion is absolutely one of those things that we oftentimes leave out of our classrooms and other academic spaces. And we have, you know, students and colleagues who are religious who feel marginalized because of it. And this marginalization culminates in the way that some religious groups, and in this case, I would say specifically the intersection between race, religion, and gender is very, very significant when it comes to the context of Western Europe, because I'm pretty sure this is not news to anybody, but like the way that Muslim women, for instance, are treated in Europe, and that oftentimes intersects with migration or migration background. And there are so many lasting tropes about religion, right? So when it comes to academic spaces that we frequent in Western Europe, religiosity as backward, religiosity as unscientific, and generally the way that secularism is also interpreted. And here, I just want to refer to the work of Saba Mahmoud, of course, in the way that secularism is considered, you know, this this way to go to arrive at a democratic society, yet that notion of secularism is interpreted in a very Eurocentric way. And I also want to add a very short note on the kind of the religion-race nexus, because religious groups also get racialized, right, as we see in anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic racism, for instance. And this is something that I at least address in my own personal academic work, but we did not necessarily explore this in the book. And as Olga said, we would very much like to address this in hopefully the next volume of the book.
And here maybe a little bit on the working process, right? On the process behind the book. We did not work on the basis of a call for papers, you know, where people would submit these and we would pick the, you know, the best ones or something like that, or, you know, have a fully diverse sample or anything. This was not at all an intention, and not at all the way we worked, right? So we approached people, primarily people from our own networks who we knew closely and who we knew are thinking and reflecting about those things and might be willing and able to open up about this. And of course, don't get us wrong, not everybody said yes, but a vast majority of people did say yes. So, you know, we would invite people and say, hey, you know, we're putting together a collective project, a collective book on migrant academics' narratives of precarity. I know, you know, you and I have had many of these conversations, you know, over coffee, over ice cream, over, you know, over dinner. Perhaps, you know, you would be ready, be willing, be able to, you know, articulate those on paper for others to read. Right. And then people would just come back to us with suggestions of what they felt comfortable writing about, or what they felt was most urgent to write about, or maybe what was their creative idea of addressing the subject. Right. So in that sense, there was not much room for us to say, hey, write about your, you know, the discriminations you've experienced as a Muslim scholar, for example, or things like that. So so yeah, just to emphasize, we did not go for, you know, the full coverage of the, you know, precarity menu. There's not such a thing to begin with. And this was not the intention behind the book. But yes, we are aware that, you know, some themes are therefore maybe more addressed than others. And it would be interesting to explore all of them over time.
Right. And thank you for those interesting responses. Lastly, you know, I also want to ask if the decision to publish a book on, you know, experiences of migrant academics in terms of precarity and resilience was open access, a conscious one.
Yes. And you know what, I want to maybe jump in here and say that for us, publishing this book, Open Access, was part of our aim to decolonize the migration discourse that we have aimed for. And so decolonization involves, of course, to go back, you know, to Mignolo, for instance, involves the linking from the coloniality of power and knowledge. And we really aim to do this by privileging silenced voices, but also making the work accessible. And that was, you know, the aim that we had and very much aligned with the open access publication that we went for. We wanted to include different kinds of geographies and histories. We wanted to include subjectivity and repressed subjectivities and subaltern voices that are not necessarily reflected in academic scholarship. Also, using narratives was for us another aspect of this decolonization project that we had to really prioritize different ways of seeing things and through autoethnography and autobiography, exploring the, again, going back to what I was saying before, the embodied and emotional experiences of being on the margins was something that we wanted to do. And yeah, to do all of this behind a paywall was just not something that we could reconcile with. We were very clear from the beginning that we you know, wanted the book to be accessible to our students and to our colleagues. And I want to add that, because I did mention decolonization, I want to say that we do not claim that we are decolonized. I don't think there is any project in the world that can claim that they are decolonized, but we try to do decolonization. We try to do decolonial thinking through our project, and do a really a decolonial exercise. So this is I think a nice formulation, because this is a path to decolonization of knowledge, but it's never full decolonization.
Yeah, and to go back to the question, you know, was it a purposeful decision? Absolutely. Publishing this book, Open Access, you know, we considered almost, you know, as a matter of principle and a matter of policy, and we were very much seeking out opportunities to do so. You know, beyond the colonial exercise that Ladan just spoke to, this was also just a matter of the book being accessible. It was also I want to say a form of protest against the, you know, conventional academic publishing, as Ladan was saying, you know, where the results of academic labor are published behind paywall, which in turn reinforce the inequalities, the exclusions, the non-belongings that we talk about on the pages of the book. We also wanted it to be accessible for precarious migrant academics who might not have access and, you know, might not work at the universities and institutions that, you know, have access and can climb over the paywalls. This was extremely important for us that it would be published open access and that it would be read and not just published.
And maybe just to add to that, to what Olga was saying, besides academics who do research, this book for us is also for educators. This is a book that we really hope will be assigned to students, will be, you know, read by a wide array of people who are in education. And having an open access publication will facilitate this, because not only for, you know, people living in precarious conditions, I think anywhere, just the price of academic books has, I don't even understand the market anymore. I don't know who can afford, you know, academic books who have, you know, price tags of like, I don't know, 75 euros for just one book. It's unbelievable. So we really wanted this book to be open access, because we thought that for everyone who wants to use this book, or not necessarily the whole of the, you know, entirety of the collection, but some of the chapters in their education, the book should be accessible to their students as well, so that they can, you know, download it and read it as they please.
Right. Thank you so much, Ladan and Olga, for talking to me about your new book. And I've read the book, quite fascinated with it. I hope that more of our listeners go and pick up a copy of the book. So thank you once again for giving us your time.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you. Thank you.